This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Excellent. Thank you everyone for being here on a Saturday afternoon. How did you love that film? So great. I am really pleased and honored to welcome Mr. Kemp Powers to UCSB.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Our Black Hollywood series. It's really a pleasure to have you here. This was an incredible project, and I'm really pleased that you were so kind to come, because you've been touring with this film for over a year, and you're wrapping up award season. I know you went to the Oscars and
BAFTA,
a lot of nominations and wins in festivals. Congratulations.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And how was that with the award season? What was that like?
It was nice. I'm just thrilled that the film was received so well, you know, because I mean, just like everyone else, I didn't work on Into the Spider-Verse, so I was a tremendous fan of the first film, just like everyone else. I actually saw it for the first time when I was still on production on Soul, my previous film. So they like brought it up to Pixar and we saw it like months before it came out. And I met Phil Lord and Chris Miller before Soul came out, and they told me that they were planning to do a sequel, and you know, they asked me if I would come on board as a director. So it was this bizarre thing where I wrapped up on Soul on like a Friday, and that Monday I was working on Spider-Verse. But Soul didn't come out for another 6 months, so by the time Soul came out, I had to like promote that film, but I wasn't thinking, I was already long into production on this one. So you know, I jumped in. It's kind of cool, like I'm finally getting a moment to breathe. Because I've been going so hard for so many years, but it was worth it. I mean, it was, I'm glad so many people connected to the film. I'm glad it did so well, was so successful. There was a lot of concern about whether people were going to connect to some of the new characters we introduced, like Spider-Punk, you know,
He was incredible.
Yeah, he almost got cut out of the movie.
Right?
Yeah.
There
were lots of debates behind the scene about, I give a lot of credit to Daniel Kaluuya who voiced him, you know, we went to Daniel, we created the character.
He's British, right?
Well, in the comics, I don't think he is. That's the thing is like when we were doing our version of Spider-Punk, we always had Daniel in mind before we even met Kaluuya. So when we were doing test animations, we were using interviews with Kaluuya because Kaluuya, he often plays American characters like in Get Out. And I just loved his speaking voice because I do a lot of theater over in the UK. And so, you know, Daniel has that that like Camden accent that was really cool.
Yeah.
So thank God he said yes to doing the film, because honestly, the way we were building the character, I couldn't really see anyone else doing it other than him. So, you know, it was real validating.
Favored him, like, you know?
The design's very different. I mean, the design of Spider-Punk, the other thing was Spider-Punk was the most expensive character to build in the film.
Really?
His animation style, the VFX on him, it was almost like he was an entire movie and built into a character. So every time he kind of passes through, you see a character, all I see is like dollar signs, like, whoa. It just got a little more expensive.
But you know, you might tell them that if any of the characters had like a spin-off show or film, like we might do Spider-Punk on that. I mean, I also like Jessica Drew, the pregnant motorcycle riding Spider-Woman.
Yeah.
It's just interesting that, I mean
Spider-Bite, she's only in it a little bit, there was a lot of work that went into it.
Amanda Steinberg was the kind of virtual.
Yeah.
The girl, and I love that idea of the girl in her room is able to kind of log on in VR and be part of this world.
Yeah.
A lot of people, even when my kids are in the VR, I'm like, what world are you in? Are you really here? They do get sucked in. But that, I thought the new characters were one of the most exciting parts of the film. And there was an explosion of them.
Yeah, and I was also excited about Miles felt like a new character to me in this.
Yeah, he did.
You know, we aged him up. We really wanted to explore, because I, as much as I loved Into the Spider-Verse, you know, he was a little kid, he was a little adolescent, and having a son of my own who went through that incredible growth spurt when he got into high school and went from like little to like taller than me,
we kind of
wanted to represent that this guy, this kid who's going into like young adulthood. And one of the things that's interesting about Miles compared to Peter Parker is that all the different variations of Peter Parker, he always lives with his Aunt May. And, you know, his parents aren't around. And I thought it was so fascinating that Miles, this inner city character, was different than Peter in that he had both of his parents. And both of his parents were pretty heavily involved in his life. You know what I mean? Both Rio, you know, his mom and his dad. And that was like super exciting because it was like, well, how does someone who becomes Spider-Man and has to work through that day in and day out deal with that when they've got, he's got basically helicopter parents. Like Aunt May doesn't care what Peter Parker's doing. It's like, hey Aunt May, see you next week. She's like, all right. Whereas Miles' dad is a cop.
Exactly.
And his mom is so it's like, how does he navigate that where they really are checking on his grades all the time?
Right.
And he, you know, and them feeling like he is squandering the potential that he has. So that was really what drew me into the film more than anything else. This dynamic between him and his parents and his family, and this idea of doing a coming of age story that's both coming of age for the kid, but also a coming of age for the parent, because parents have to kind of go through this transformation and from when their young person is suddenly a young adult moving into adulthood.
So you brought your own experience with your son.
Yes.
Into that role.
I thought
that was really beautiful, actually. As a parent, I was reflecting on the fact that sometimes it's just so hard to talk to your kids or to hear them and be heard.
Yeah.
And there was that beautiful moment where he doesn't know it's his son. He thinks he's talking to Spider-Man. He's kind of opening up about how he feels inadequate as the father, right? And he's able to tell his dad things that he doesn't feel comfortable saying, like, give him a break, you know?
Yeah, get off the kid's ass, which we wrote that like in the booth with Shamik. It was like,
really?
Should I say?
Because like, it felt like natural.
Yeah,
right?
It was. It was one of those kind of like things we ad-libbed right in the booth. It was a lot of fun.
I love that he has a family. Mm-hmm. My children and I also have a running joke every time we see, you know, a Disney film or film with children. It's like, oh, they're orphans or something's happened to them. Mm-hmm. Like devastating traumatic has happened to their parents in order to set them on this journey of self-discovery, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not the case in this film, which comes out as refreshing, that we don't need to have a broken family.
Right.
And I think, and this is one of the questions you got ahead of me already that I wanted to ask about in terms of Miles Morales being a Afro-Puerto Rican teenager in Brooklyn in a rich cultural community neighborhood as a New Yorker, born in Brooklyn, raised in Manhattan, really appreciate, thank you, young best president, a day. You know, the richness of how the neighborhood was presented, I think the first film kind of just had like trains and scenes, but this felt really like showing parts of the neighborhood, the bodega, the block, the guys playing,
the
scenes from the city, the barbecue on the rooftop. It was like Brooklyn was a character.
Yeah, that was a goal.
The community was a character.
That was absolutely a goal. I mean, and it wasn't just myself or the other film. I mean, everyone on the filmmaking team was really encouraged to kind of bring their knowledge and their expertise, you know, to every scene. Like to some, the wonderful thing
but
about
this. You brought
the
Brooklyn, right?
I mean, I brought a lot of it, but there were other people. Like one of my favorite things, there was a Puerto Rican animator who, when he was doing his dailies, he was the one who added Rio snapping her fingers like that and a little Puerto Rican flag popped up.
Yes!
He dropped that in there and we were like, that's great!
That's,
you know,
awesome.
So that's the thing. We encourage our animators to pitch ideas.
The food they were cooking?
Well, the food, we went back. I mean, God, that barbecue,
it was one of the
scenes where we spent so much time obsessing over the stupid flan. You know, because they're like, oh, it's not shiny. Like everyone was trying to get their foods in and but that was actually a lot of fun. Is that element of people kind of feeling comfortable enough to bring their personal experience and what they knew about it. Understanding that no one person can speak for an entire culture.
Of course.
But probably the most extreme case of that and how it transformed the film was actually when he went to Mombatan. Because we had like an entire version of that scene really built out that we felt relatively good about. And then our animation team is very diverse. It's people from all ethnicities, you know, from all over the world. And a group of our Indian and Indian American animators, particularly in Canada as well as India, kind of got together and wrote us an email and just said that, like,
wow,
look, POV isn't cool.
Right.
And then wow, they did. They were like, look, this doesn't represent a realistic version of our culture. And what we did was we set up a Zoom call, myself and Phil and Chris and the other directors, and they kind of laid out all the problems they had with it. And wow, even though we were pretty far along in production, we then went ahead and assembled a writer's room of all Indian and Indian American writers. And we kind of looked at the sequence, and we just, it wasn't even really reworking the sequence. It was like, it was an all day conversation about culture. Like, they watch it and they give us notes and they talk about things from their childhood and all that stuff. Then we went back and we very quickly rewrote the entire sequence, rebroke the entire sequence.
Wow.
And it went from what was one of the weakest sequences in the entire film to one of the ones we enjoyed the most. I mean, I think it was,
well,
I think it was Hasan Minhaj who was in the room. The comedian Hasan Minhaj was in the room, and he was the one who talked about his hair and, like, using coconut oil in prayer. And I was like, yep, we're putting that in. Like, it was just a lot of people just flipping things at us, and we were just, like, writing, and then, you know, we presented a new version of it. And
I still go around saying, it's, you know, say TT.
Yeah.
Chai tea. I think that this is why representation matters, mm-hmm, and diversity matters, having people behind the camera in the animation room who are not the only one and feel like they can't speak up, like, yeah, actually having a collective of people, of diverse people, who to be able to, and also to have the right directors and writers on the team who are willing to listen and willing to revisit, because that's very expensive to go back and redo that work.
That's what's important. It's not about, like, what skin color I am. It's about my willingness to listen. Because I could be black, you could be Asian, and you could still be a knucklehead and not want to listen to anyone else's ideas or opinions.
That's right.
It's very important that you're open, and because we're artists, we're very sensitive, we have egos, we're defensive, we have certain production burdens that we have put on us, where it's like, this is going to cost money, and let's be real, like, you know, adding money onto your budget means that the barrier to success is that much harder. So it takes a certain amount of not just openness, but kind of bravery to do that. And that wasn't just me. It was, like, me, it was Phil, it was Chris, it was Christina, it was Amy, it was Avi, it was Joaquim, you know, it was Justin. Like, we would kind of have a quorum and discuss these things. But I think everyone in our team had a general sense of, like, openness, that we don't know everything. We all have blind spots.
Interesting.
You know, like, I'm a black guy from New York, but I have, like, my own kinds of blind spots. You know, I have gender blind spots. Like, and it's actually an unfair burden to put on any one person to them speak for or try to represent any entire group. And I think in the past there's been a certain amount of laziness about that. It's like, okay, we got a black guy, we got a woman, so now that's covered.
That's done.
And it's like, how did that end up so bad? It had a woman. It's like, because they can't represent everyone from a community that way.
Don't get me started talking about some of these shows.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, what you're saying is really powerful, and you know, speaks to the way that, you know, there's been this push in Hollywood, and there's also been a backlash to, like, DEI and inclusion efforts, and we're still not quite there yet. Which brings me back to Miles's, you know, kind of Afro-Latinidad culture, and how so much in the history of film, in comics, television, animation history, if you think about how black boys are represented, it's has a long history of being the butt of the racist humor, being superficial kind of coonish characters, characters, again, from broken homes, illiterate or criminal. We have this really moral good kid who's not like Cosby Show moral, like thou shalt, middle class politics moral. Really of the community, really caring, even though his dad's like, well, we are not struggling. You know, they have a little bit of privilege. But one thing that struck me is the fact that Miles's dad is a cop protects him from the ordinary kinds of material racial violence that most Black children face in America, who don't have cops as dads, right? And I think in some ways it's like, it shows, it gives us an imagination of what that kind of safety can look like for that would allow a child to kind of grow into their personhood without it, like the weight of like epistemic systemic violence every day. The violence that he's facing is like represented in The Prowler and other kinds of bad guys, and is an intense one. But it's a different kind of violence that a lot of Black children have faced in real life and in media. And so it struck me that the representation that you created and your team is really groundbreaking for that, because I'm trying to think back to like the history of cinema to see other Black boy child characters like that. And they don't really appear.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think what Ryan did with Black Panther was pretty groundbreaking and revolutionary. It's very interesting, because the thing about Miles Morales is that, you know, for a certain generation, people of a certain age or younger, he's their primary Spider-Man.
Right.
And for those young people, it's not just like young Black or Latino kids. For certain, like kids of a certain age, largely because of things like Into the Spider-Verse and how popular that film became for a lot of young kids. It was, it's just like how
I think Gen Z, that's their norm, right?
Yeah, well,
for
like
us, we had the Corey White guy.
It was May the 4th. It's like May the 4th tomorrow.
May the 4th
and
be with you.
And it's the 25th anniversary of the prequels. And like, I remember when those prequels came out of Star Wars, a lot of people in my generation, Gen X, were like, oh man, these are terrible, we don't like them. But that, for a certain generation of young people, that's their Star Wars,
you know?
And I think it's just about what you grow up with being kind of like your foundational thing. So it's, it was actually really encouraging and exciting that Miles has been like a foundational, he is the primary Spider-Man for a younger generation that I don't even think puts all of that that on him. He's just like, he's their Spider-Man. He's cool, you know, he's one of the biggest things that we talked about when we started this film. Was it was really important, based on how it ended on the first film, that this film opens up with Miles being competent. He's the Spider-Man for his city. It's really important that when we open the film, it's evident he doesn't need help to protect the city. And it sounds like a little thing, but like he goes on this journey of kind of getting his sea legs. We really wanted to show like, here's a guy who the city feels comfortable being protected by this hero. And it's those little subtle things that I think, like, again, it was really cool to see that, you know, for a lot of young people, he just is Spider-Man. And you know, we're human beings. I'm not on social media, but we are aware of the conversations that happen. And there was like a certain trolling. Brian Michael Bendis created Miles Morales. And he was a producer on our film. And, you know, Brian is a white guy, and he's in a, you know, he has a multi-ethnic family. And I didn't really have much experience with the comic books when they came out. But I was aware that there was a certain kind of like trolling component when it came to Miles Morales' character. Like, he's not really Spider-Man, you know. Peter Parker's Spider-Man, and, you know, Miles Morales is Miles Morales. And I was like, well, he's wearing a spider, you know, whatever. So we wanted to kind of have a little bit of fun with that. Like the whole, it's a not very subtle thing when Miguel has him like pinned to the train and is like, you're not supposed to be Spider-Man. Yeah, he's both talking about that, but he's also talking about all the trolls who are just saying like Miles isn't supposed to be Spider-Man. And the thing is, like, I think that the greatest sign of our success with this film is that even a lot of those trolls enjoyed the movie, because it was just a good story.
They had
it was just like a good story.
Came around,
That it was like a good journey that we went on, and you know, they're curious what's going to happen next. They care about the characters. They feel, you know, connected to the characters, and that's really the big win, because we all grew up reading comic books, and we all liked Wolverine just because he was cool. You know what I mean? And it was just like, we just wanted Miles to be aspirational. And the things that make him aspirational are not necessarily textbook kind of things. He's aspirational when he's this and this and this. He's just aspirational because he's dope and he's cool. And kids want to be heroes. They don't think, well, I want to make sure I'm the hero who is the most more. No, you just want someone's cool. And so that it sounds like a very small thing, but it's easy to kind of get lost in the weeds of thinking about what people want or what they expect. And like we trust in ourselves and we trust in each other as artists. We think we have good taste. We know what makes us excited and what we want to see. And that's kind of always been our North Star.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I think that I was also blown away by Issa Rae playing Jessica Drake as
Drew.
You know,
Jessica Drew, yeah.
Drew, sorry, as the brightest Spider-Man, and her kind of motherly relationship with Gwen. She's like, adopt me. But how, she's like one of the only Spider-Man who doesn't have to wear a mask. She's just herself. Yeah. She's just like.
Because in her background, she doesn't have a secret identity.
Yeah, she's not so secret. She's just like, I'm pregnant and I'm here and I'm authentic. It seems like authenticity ran through a lot of.
And we're thrilled with like Gwen. I mean, Gwen was really secondary, and it was a kind of a choice. The choice that scared all of us the most was the fact that we were going to open the film with 15 minutes of Gwen and not see Miles. Yeah. But I mean, what we wanted to do with her character, it was really the only, part of it was like where we were trying to take Gwen's character. Part of it was we knew we were gonna bring a new visual language to this film. And it's like, okay, why don't, we could take the route where we kind of ease people into some of the new visual language, or we can just like come right out the gate
right
and
out.
See like, this is going to be completely different visually. Maybe you'll get up and leave, but like this is what we're going to be doing. And we obviously decided to kind of like go with the most extreme visual language of the film right before, technically before even the opening credits.
I was going to ask you about that because, well, it's so spectacular as a piece of animation feat and history, like what an accomplishment. The kind of work that went into the artwork in this film is just astounding. I know it took over 3 years to create it, right?
Yeah, more than that.
Which is just spectacular. But that opening scene with the painterly quality, and don't even get me started on that, the vulture character too, in the Museum of Modern Art, which I absolutely love.
Yeah, the Guggenheim.
The Guggenheim, and the interior kind of commentary on art and the Jeff Koons and all was really quite.
He was such a good sport stunning. Too, because we were like,
what do you say about Jeff Koons being inside Jeff Koons' art?
Yeah. We had to get permission. It was really kind of like the one line everyone was freaked out about. He's like, you call that art? And we're like, Jeff Koons isn't going to let us say that, but he was totally down with it. So we made like the whole museum a kind of a Koons retrospective. So there's a lot of his art in there. And we all have like strong feelings about Calder. So we were like, let's make a big ugly Calder sculpture and have that be like deadly.
I mean, so that whole 15 minutes, it wasn't any dead weight. It was a perfect kind of immersion into the world that you were building. Well, one of the worlds, because we're actually in a multiverse.
I'm glad you think so, because people were like, it's too long. So we were like, it was, we kind of broke some of our own filmmaking rules, but thank God. I mean, people seem to go along for
when that title sequence hits and it's like, boom, and you're like, oh my God, I've already been so deep in it. Now you're just breaking up the title scene. Yeah. I think that it's beautiful. And the ways that the colors change and this kind of beautiful falling of the way that
it's a mood ring. The whole world is supposed to represent her emotion, which is
beautiful.
It's kind of like the comics that inspired it did a lot of that. There's like a gouache watercolor element of it. And also one of the other directors, Justin Thompson, one of his favorite animated films is Cinderella. And there's a point in Cinderella where her stepsisters are kind of like ripping her clothes off. And there's a very subtle change of color. So we wanted to do a more extreme version of that, where if you rewatch Cinderella and her evil, stepsisters are ripping her clothes off. Every time they rip a piece off, it's like the colors change, and it kind of changes the tone and the mood of the moment. I mean, again, we all have, there's so much, we would have these, visual, inspiration boards and kinds of things that we were, and that was really a good starting point for us.
You were working with really class act artists who know a lot about visual history and media. And I think that the animation, I guess one of my questions related to this is how does animation allow a different kind of storytelling? You have worked on Pixar film, one of my favorite animated films of all time, Soul. Thank you for that film. That really helped my children get through dealing with my parents passing when they're little and have a reference point to talk about when I say that they're in heaven or what is that? And then you've worked live action with One Night in Miami. So you've had like very different experiences, both in animation and live action. Mm-hmm. But from the perspective of working on a project like this, where you're talking about how deep the animation goes, what does animation allow for storytelling that's really different than other kinds of filmmaking?
I think it's the iterative process. I mean, when you're working in live action, specifically if you're working on film, I mean, you can't, the thing about animation is when you're seeing an animated film, you're seeing like the 30th or 40th version of the film. We're able to start off in 2D storyboards and make a complete version of that film with scratch voice acting before we've even cast it and share it with people. And based off of that, we kind of blow the film up again and again and again. So an editor on an animated film is in the edit suite with us from the very, very beginning.
Wow. Constantly refining.
Yes, constantly reworking it, constantly rewriting it, constantly reperforming it, redrawing. It doesn't, you know, until we start actually putting it into 3D. And even then, there's room for us to make changes and adjustments as we're doing it in 3D. When you're in live action, the editor doesn't really get involved until later on because you have to have things that you've shot. And if it's in film particular, it's not limitless. You know what I mean? It can't just be like, oh, we didn't bother shooting that. You would have to do reshoots in live action. Animation, the animated version of reshoots is just par for the course. You're making the film again and again and again. Like at Pixar, the way it worked was it could be called like a brain trust screening. Every 12 weeks, we would screen a version of the film for everyone at Pixar, and then we'd have a brain trust meeting for like 3 hours and get notes. And you usually have between 7 and 10 of those.
Wow.
As you're making the film. That's a lot. And with this film, I mean, it wasn't even that far apart. I mean, we would just keep on working on new versions and drop them and then you can learn a lot from the audience screenings. But it's this kind of iterative process where you're making versions of the film again and again, and you just hope that the version that ends up being the one made is the best version of the film. Sometimes you have this weird thing where you do a version of it and you kind of go like, no, it was better 4 months ago. And other times, even when it's good, you're like, could it be better? And you're encouraged to really like try to do some pretty dramatic changes. There's a lot of like blowing it up. So if you're like really sensitive and think like, here it is and it's perfect, you probably shouldn't do a lot of animation, because there's no world where like the first version we do, they're like,
goodbye,
do it. No. Like that's,
don't hold on to that.
No, you can't, because you have to, even if everyone loves it, you got to try some other things. And it's, you don't know what's possible until you keep on trying things and trying things and trying things. And honestly, it's just the clock that runs out on you. That's the only thing that really stops you. And of course, as you begin to animate it in 3D, it becomes exponentially more expensive. It's a 2D storyboarding process. That's why, I mean, I'm a little bit different in that a lot of people who become animation directors are storyboard artists first. It's a little more unusual for a writer or an animator to move into the director's chair.
Yeah, like your co-director.
Like Joaquim was a storyboard artist first. Justin was a production designer first. So we all kind of each had our own superpowers, so to speak. But the thing about 2D storyboarding is it teaches you the basics of visual storytelling, which is, I think, pretty critical when it comes to making a film like this. So I've had people ask me like, well, I really want to be a director of animation, and it's like, oh, like I come from live action theater. I kind of evolved into this is just one medium that I work in. But if you're really passionate about the animation medium, I think storyboarding is really kind of like the basic step that really kind of leads you to the director's chair, like the head of story on your film, who is like the person who runs a story team. It's not uncommon for the head of story on one movie to be the director on another movie. It's kind of like the career path for a lot of people. Like Soul, we had an amazing head of story, Trevor Jimenez, who, some of my favorite scenes in the film were things that like he helped conceptualize and board. And, you know, it was similar, you know, in this film we had like Octavio Rodriguez, you know, and yeah, we have like the head of story is like a critical position in the animation team.
Wow. Well, this makes me ask, because you had like a kind of non-traditional route to this world, starting out in being a playwright, did you bring some theater expertise into this?
Absolutely.
Project?
I mean, I love working with actors. That's a part of it in theater. It's great because when you're a playwright, you're not necessarily a director when you are a playwright, but regardless, you're there with the director working with the actors the entire time. So I really enjoy the element of working with the performers and trying to pull a little bit more out of the performance, whether, you know, and you can do that with a vocal performance in a way that I think people take for granted. There's sometimes when you're hearing a vocal performance, it's not uncommon in animation for, we call it kludging, but it's basically like you Frankenstein a take together. So someone does a bunch of reads and then you can edit, like take a piece of this sentence from that take and that one and kind of get the performance you want. You would never, the human ear wouldn't really know the difference.
And sometimes the actors are not even in the room together.
They're never in the room together. Actors recorded those different lines on different days and we're cutting it together. I actually like trying to get the straight performance from the actor. A great example of that is like when Rio is talking to Miles before he heads off and she has this like incredibly long monologue. That was like one take with Luna. You know what I mean? And I've been in situations where something like that, you're like, all right, let's take, you know, take three from that one, take seven from that one, and you cut it together. Mm-hmm. And it was instead, Luna and I just kind of worked it where, you know, I read opposite her, you know, when she did like full versions of it, she like actually started crying several times. Like it was a very emotional moment for her. And I was like playing Miles. And it was like, so it was like real emotion as opposed to like cutting it. It's just a choice. And I like that. And that, for me, at least, that comes so much from theater because I really just, you know, we can do it, but I like just getting the straight performance, the straight reads and just picking a read as opposed to cutting them, a couple of them together.
You can totally, it feels more like an ensemble cast.
Yeah. Right. And we have very little of them in each other's. I mean, some actors, we did a couple with Gwen and her dad. So we would have Shay and Haley together a couple of times. Mm-hmm. We did a couple, one or two with Gwen and Jess Drew. So we had Issa and Haley together and a couple with Shamik and Haley with Gwen and Miles. Yeah. But other than those couple of instances, no one else was ever in the same room. No one ever recorded together. And in fact, yeah, it was a lot of people didn't know who the other people were in the movie. Like I remember when I told Mahershala, he was like, well, who's playing this version of Miles? And I was like, Jarell Jerome. He's like, oh, I know that kid. We were in Moonlight together. Like they don't even, because everyone has to sign an NDA.
Yeah,
so no one even knows who else is in the film often
what?
Until really, really late in the process.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that's so we can't even get like a hint of what's next because you left Miles in this like precarious place where he's like about to be murdered by himself and we can't even like know like this is a real danger. He has secret powers that the other Miles don't know about.
You can write
he's
all the fan fiction you want, but you can go down that rabbit hole. But
fan fiction is a wonderful genre, always what you want to do. Take your own path. I mean, did you feel pressure from like the fan stands? They could be really passionate about what they want to see in their sequels.
Not really. Like I said, I'm not on social media or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's tough for me because I'm a fan myself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, but I don't always, I like talking to fans after the movies come out. You know, when we're in production, to me, that's just noise. Mm-hmm. And often, some of the things that I ended up loving the most, when I heard it was being made, I was like, that's gonna suck. You know, like I was so cynical about it. I thought, like, people have such short memories. And if you follow like comic books or comic book movies, I remember when they announced that like Heath Ledger was gonna play the Joker and people were like rioting. They were like, that's good. The guy from 10 Things I Hate About You, he sucks. And it's like the seminal performance of the Joker in The Dark Knight. People were mad. People are just, there's that. And I've dealt with a lot of fandom because remember, I worked on Star Trek too. So like talk about fandom, like, Jesus Christ. It's just like, you can't.
You worked on Discovery.
Yeah, like there's this whole thing with canon and rules. and what you can and can't do. But you know, here's a little secret. A lot of the people who are making a lot of your beloved things, we're all like flying by the seat of our pants. It's not as well thought out as you think it is. Like, there was one particular guy, I won't say his name, but like I worked with him on Discovery and he had worked on like The Next Generation and stuff. And we were talking about an episode that he wrote. And I was like, oh my God, that episode. Like, I kid you not, I don't think he remembered writing it. Like,
really?
He was like in an altered state or something.
For, like the most
and to be perfectly honest, I would probably fail a quiz on this movie within a couple of months because my mind is onto another thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, when we were in it, we were in it. We got it done. It's your child. It goes out in the world. And the second it's out in the world, it doesn't belong to us anymore. Across the Spider-Verse doesn't belong to me, Joaquin, Justin, Phil Lord, Chris Miller. It belongs to fans. Fans mm-hmm. should take it, make whatever they want of it. And that's how it's, that to me, that's the good part of fandom. Just like take something you love and run with it. But like, and I'm just the guy who put it out there, helped put it out there. And I'm kind of like going to do something else. But in terms of the engagement, I'm just like, I don't know. Like, if they hate it, I guess it's cool to hear that after the fact. But like, I want to tell this. I just want to tell a good story.
After all the work you put in, I would cry if somebody said that. But
no,
I
but if people
can be mean.
You obviously don't remember Discovery because whew, they really hated that one. So
I thought it was a pushback against, you know, Michael's character being black and.
There was a lot of hate, and it's the Klingon, everything. It was anyway. Let's not go down the Discovery road. I like to put that one out. I like to put that one out of my head.
I like that series, and I really like that character, and I think that you know, it was a great series. Mm-hmm. I like all your projects, and I'm just really glad that you're here. And I just wanted to say how much we appreciate this project and just your frankness and authenticity and. You know, like I said, I think that representation is meaningful. And I'm so happy that this new generation, like, they get to have this hero. Because Tobey Maguire and all that, like, wasn't as inspirational or meaningful to me, honestly, when I was coming up. I think that we had fewer heroes that kind of spoke our
language. I love it. I mean, you got to understand, too, for me, I'm Gen X, so Tobey Maguire is my Spider-Man, more so than Tom Holland and Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
To me, Spider-Man 2 was like the high watermark of like the Spider-Man
movie.
I didn't
like all those three. I mean, they don't look like they belong in New York. It looked like there's some bridge and tunnel.
I just loved it.
Come down from Westchester Spider-Mans. Like, Miles, at least from the neighborhood, he knows how to get to, like, swing his butt over to where he's
got to go. I get it, but I made this. I'm just talking about the ones that I liked as
Toby
a fan.
Looked like he'd be, like, asking directions.
And Tobey Maguire was, like, my Spider-Man. So
I'm Gen X too, but I do think that things are transforming so much, and
there's room for all of us.
There's room. There's
you know,
room.
If all of us can sit in this room, all of us can have art that appeals to. Like, come on, there's room for everyone.
But one more thing, because we're gonna take questions. I want to ask just about the little brief glimpse of Donald Glover.
Yeah.
the kind of. You had this moment where he's like live action in the Spider-Verse world, which was incredible with all the millions of Spider-Men chasing. That was just a monumental scene. But when we see him, that was a cool surprise and a few moments of integrating the live action there. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? And that was a fun idea.
Yeah, I mean, I was really excited. And we managed to keep it pretty secret, which was awesome. But I think initially we knew we wanted to do something live action. And for a long time, we were talking about that being Andrew Garfield. We even had like a version that was like 2D storyboards where Andrew Garfield's character shows up. And I just think we all thought it was kind of corny. And it was like, could we do something that's a lot, like a bit less lazy, a little more interesting, a little bit more subversive. And we remembered that in, you know, that one Spider-Man movie, Donald Glover was Uncle Aaron. So it was like, all right, let's make him just
that
be the Prowler. And we didn't even ask Donald till late in the game. So for a number of screenings for audiences, we would have, for that scene, you'd see it miles go by, and it would be like a, it looked like South Park. It was like a 2D cutout with like Donald Glover's face and a flappy mouth. Like, hi, I'm Donald Glover. It was just, and everyone would laugh. And we were like, oh, did anyone ask Donald Glover if he's gonna do this yet? And thank God he said yes. And I mean, The movie came out in June. I think we recorded Donald in like April, if I'm thinking straight.
Just made it.
Yeah, like we just made it. We had a great costume designer who like made this Prowler costume, and Donald was in New York. It was like a 4-hour session. You know, we had him sitting on a little stage cross-legged, and we're just like throwing lines at him, and it came together. It came together really nicely. But it was we just thought that was a little bit more of a funny, kind of quirky, you know, surprise that and we know people had talked about Donald Glover being Miles Morales back in the day, and just kind of a fun little tongue-in-cheek. You know, it's a Lord Miller production. We want to have a little fun.
Lego Spider World were some of my favorite surprise moments.
Oh, God. I mean, the Lego thing, too. I mean, I'm sure you know about that. Like, the kid we ended up hiring to do it, because when we released... Yeah, it was a 14-year-old who did that. Because when we released our first teaser trailer, we didn't know it was a kid, by the way.
Wow.
When we released the first teaser trailer, someone had done, like, a beat-by-beat recreation of our teaser in Legos. So then we were having, for a while, we had Miles, we had the spot going to all these different dimensions, and it was like, Phil and Chris were like, well, we should have him go to a Lego dimension. And we were, should we get that guy who did the Lego version of the trailer? And then, of course, we reached out and found out that it was, like, a kid, and then we were like, can we hire a kid? It was really weird and then of course we were trying to like reach out to the kid, and the kid didn't press it, and he didn't believe it was us, and his parents didn't believe it was us, and then it was like a whole to-do. We got it sorted out. Like, he was like working on his shots after class, and he got them in, and it came together pretty nicely.
We loved it. We do a lot of Legos in my house, so yeah, every time we see, like, they just scream.
Oh, that guy among our crew that gets the biggest laugh, just because when he Nick Novicki, who voices Peter, he does the boop, 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 boop,
yeah,
which we love, and also that we have Miguel says like he's we have Miguel say like you're one of our best. And it's literally the only spider person he compliments in the whole film is a little Lego, and we just sit there and laugh so hard that like Miguel's such a hard ass that the only person he actually respects enough to compliment is the Lego dude.
See, he does have a soft underbelly.
And then he shows up later when he pops up on the little he's on the Spider-Man Jeep. He kind of shows up. He's like right there. Boop! If you look really closely.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna look again.
He's in the posse chasing after Miles.
I've seen it like 5 or 6 times, and I learn something new every time.
Yeah.
We're gonna take questions from the audience, sure. Right, Emily? Thank you so much.
Yeah. Hi, Kemp. I'm from Brooklyn, as me and Ray was saying earlier.
What neighborhood?
I'm from Clinton Hill, and then we moved to Canarsie.
Oh. So. Flatbush.
I love a Flatbush, but yeah, Flatbush is Flatbush.
Yeah.
As somebody that loves this, grew up watching Toby, grew up loving all these different Spider-Man movies, and as a fan, somebody that's also a writer, how did the aspect of writing this versus, I guess, watching those live action Spider-Man, Did you take anything differently, any different approach than you would a live action Spider-Man, knowing that you're gonna go through different versions? But did you feel like you could be freer, or did you feel like you were stricter because of the continuity of the one that just happened, and then now this new one that's gonna also have one after it?
Yeah, I don't think we definitely weren't stricter, that's for sure. And understand, when we're making these films, we're not thinking of this film as an animated film. We're just thinking of it like straight up as a film. You know, the idea obviously started with Phil and Chris, who are pretty brilliant writers, and then Dave Callahan was brought on, and of course I helped do a lot of writing, like in the edit, you know, because I'm a writer as well. No. I mean, that's one of the strange things, is that when you're writing this kind of stuff, you're not thinking, I am writing an animated movie. No, we're writing it and making it as though we're just making a film. Like, we're not even, no offense, we're not even thinking like kids. We're thinking, and part of it is that, like, good kids are, first, kids are sophisticated. And the best animated films, the best films in general, family films is the best way to say it, are equally enjoyable to adults and children. Because, you know, and that's a challenge. I learned some lessons on working on Soul, because we would screen it for an audience, and the parents would say, like, this film is way too complex for my child, at which point the kid would be like, mom, dad, and explain it to them. and that's the thing, is that we tend to forget that, like, in maybe adults tend to be not honest about it or emotionally honest, but kids are very sophisticated. So I'm just treating it as the only thing we have to keep in mind is, like, not too much cursing, you know, obviously, because we don't want to get, we got to have our PG rating. But from a storytelling standpoint, there really isn't that much. That the biggest difference is that when it's an animated film, you rarely have the whole script put together, because there's a time when you have one copy of the script, then you immediately break it up into its component sequences. So you have a board with all these sequences. And from there, you are writing and rewriting things out of sequence, and you rarely put it all back together again. So we didn't really pull together a completed script until, like, years into the process. And we were kind of like, oh my God, the script is 290 pages. Like, we had to, like, reformat it and everything, because we were working in those component sequences, where if it's live action, usually you kind of lock the script, and that's the script, and everyone gets a copy of the script. Even the performers never get the script. They get scenes. So, and it's usually not their first scene. So the first few recording sessions, that's why they're so challenging, because the actor's like, what the F is going on here? Like, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And then over time, as other scenes start getting recorded and they start seeing it get stitched together, it starts making sense. That's the biggest difference, is just that we're working out a sequence and we rarely see the completed script, because the film is being cut together in edit. And, you know, we don't conform everything until, like, much, much later on in the process.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, first, thank you for sharing your creativity. It's really beautiful, all the work you do.
Thanks.
And I have one question, because I watch really close Soul and Spider-Man. And to me, it was really beautiful how you show death, right? And how difficult it is to portray death, right? And in a different way. You know, in Soul, it's more specific, but this is also that. Not let die people or understand the die of people. So how was this process to you and your and the team to discuss and show that to children or teenagers, how difficult and how, how was, thank you.
And you, are you talking more about Soul than this?
Both.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of harkens back to the same answer I gave him about, like, young people's sophistication, you know. I think back to my childhood, and one of my favorite films was Bambi, right? Mm. It's one of the most iconic Disney films of all time. His mother gets freaking shot. Then his no-account dad shows up and is like, you're coming with me, Bambi. Then he's gotta fight off another buck who's about to rape his girl. Like, Bambi is dark. Bambi is a dark, and it's like what kid hasn't seen it? It's just about, young people are capable of processing these things, and we have to learn to process them, unless we just, like, all want to just take our Xanax and, like, hide under a rock somewhere. Like, this is just, we have to be able to learn to process these things. And I think that's storytelling, fairy tales. If you go back to, like, fairy tales, it's even darker stuff. You know what I mean? Like, the whole point of these things were, I think, we have to face these things. We have to face a certain amount of darkness. Another one of my favorite animated films, which I think did cause a lot of controversy, was Watership Down, which, you know, is like a rabbit warren. And you want to talk about, like, some brutal stuff. Even, like, watching The Dark Crystal when I was a kid. I remember when I first showed my daughter The Dark Crystal, she was, like, scared. You know, not the one that was on Netflix, like the original Dark Crystal when it came out in theaters. The Skeksis were, like, terrifying. And the Skeksis, like, descend on one of their own and rip them apart. And then you find out that the Skeksis and the elders are linked. So if one dies, they die. So that you learn that you cannot have good without evil. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's this. It's really sophisticated stuff. And I think I'm just accustomed to that kind of sophisticated storytelling being woven into what my kids, young people's movies. You've seen Gremlins? When they feed them after dark and all of a sudden they're demons in the theater, I was like, what is happening right now? Like, I saw that in a theater and you didn't see it. Now everyone knows what Stripe was. When you saw it originally, you didn't know Gizmo and then we're going to turn into like lizard things.
Yes.
And like,
you're right.
And kill people.
Yeah.
And Gremlins freaked us out. And then we left kind of thrilled, you know? So I don't want to be dismissive about it. But again, I think that part of the job of telling a good story is dealing with some like complex emotion. And as a storyteller, I always come from this place of like emotion. Someone asks like, why are you telling a story? And I always come back to some kind of like emotional answer, some kind of emotion I want people to feel, some kind of issue that in many cases, if I'm being honest, I'm struggling with as a human being. And that's the very reason that I want to tell the story myself, because it's something that I'm struggling with and I process it through this art. And hopefully if it connects to people, it will help them process the same thing that I am processing. You know, Soul was very, very specific because, newsflash, it was a 40-something year old guy who'd been trying to be an artist and failing. And, you know, his mother's like, baby, you gotta give up. I like, that was like verbatim a conversation I had with my mom. In my 40s with kids of my own, still borrowing money. Like, I was processing. Soul was like my therapy session. You know what I mean? Because it's like when you don't know what else you're gonna do with your life, you know? And it's getting to a point where like, you're not a kid anymore. And you know, you're starting to feel irresponsible. I mean, but we turned that into a kids movie that I think kids kind of got with and really dug. And I think we always planned for Joe Gardner to like die in the very beginning of the film, which was, that's like the whole point. Like the way Soul was structured was that like, why is it that people feel like their lives don't have value, okay? So Joe dies, so to speak, and he's like, I can't die now. I finally am doing something valuable with my life. But by the end, he plays that piano, and after 22's been from his POV seeing his own life, he realizes that his life has been full of richness and value. That's the point of Soul. That's something I had to come to, and Pete Doctor had to come to, that like people need to stop believing that their lives aren't good enough. And social media's so magnified that because people create a fake version of happiness and success and it makes everyone feel like a loser.
That's true.
And the goal of Soul was like to remind everyone in the world that we're not losers. In the game of life, the fact that we are engaged with life makes us winners. Like that's it. Very simple stuff. A kid should
Beautiful.
Be able, and shouldn't a kid get that message?
Yeah.
You know? So it really isn't even about death. It's about life.
Yeah.
And like, value your life while you're living it, not when you're about to die.
Beautiful.
I wanted to say primarily, Across the Spider-Verse was very revolutionary for animation as a whole. And I kind of just wanted to ask, like, all these ideas for the kind of 2.5D vision for this movie, what was it like linking that to the actual like implementation and development of those ideas? Like, what is that process of translation like, especially in terms of modifying softwares and like what specific, you know, group of people with like specific occupations made that happen?
Sure, that's a great question. Ooh. Funny thing is, there is no 2D in this. This whole film was made in 3 dimensions. And the trick was taking 3D animation and putting a 2D looking skin on it. So that's kind of like part of the fun we have. And a lot of credit goes to our VFX department and the folks at Sony Pictures Imageworks. Sony Pictures Imageworks doesn't just do animation, they do like the live action effects for the live action Spider-Man movies and a lot of other stuff. And this was a film that was exciting because we presented a whole ton of ideas to them that they didn't have answers to right away. And they had to kind of like figure it out while we were in production. And the anxiety-inducing part of that is that you get to a point where it's like, wow, we really need to figure this out soon because the movie's coming out in 6 months. And you kind of start getting closer to the deadline. But they figured it all out. But see, the way I talked about 2D storyboarding, the next step in the chain when you're making an animated film is a stage that some people don't like it, but it's called layout. That's where you create a 3D environment in the computer. Layout is critical because that's when you set the camera. That's when your cinematographer kind of takes over. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes you'll see a 2D storyboard, it's not thinking about the three-dimensional space. So when you start putting it into a three-dimensional space and have to build a set, you realize things don't work. But the film has to be built in three dimensions. So you have three dimensions for you to set the cameras, and then the animators are animating all 3D images. All the characters are 3D. But then when it gets lit and the VFX come on, that's when we start drawing it and doing things that then make it retroactively look like it's two-dimensional sometimes. But the whole movie is 3D. It's just the effect sometimes makes it look like it's 2D. But if I showed you the rough animated version of the entire film, it's this entire film with three-dimensional characters performing, and it's the lighting and the VFX that change certain things to look like those, to look like 2D, to look like Lego, to look like all these other different things. So it's just, you know, the folks in our VFX department are magicians, but it's, that's pretty much how it's done.
We have to let him go, but yeah. We're having so much fun, and would you visit us again sometime?
Oh, sure, sure.
We'd love to have you.
Yeah, it's just a long drive from LA. I'm like, oh my God, what time am I going to get home tonight? Anyway, but yeah, it's good. I'll drive back up here again.
Well, no worries, we could put you up in the door.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. And thank you.
Oh, Kent, my pleasure. Powers. Thanks for
pleasure.
Having me. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.